Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. From Carl's Jr. to Whole Foods, sustainable, humane meat is being marketed as an alternative to animal cruelty in factory farms. In December, Carl's Jr. introduced what it says is the first all-natural, no-hormones, no-steroids, grass-fed, free-range beef patty. Whole Foods recently launched a $20 million ad campaign called Values Matter, which emphasizes the company's commitment to animals and the environment. One campaign poster shows a woman holding a chicken with the words, "Know what kind of life your dinner lived?" But how humane is it? Over the past few weeks, the animal liberation group Direct Action Everywhere has been holding in-store protests at Whole Foods across the country over the alleged mistreatment of hens raised and slaughtered at Petaluma Farms, a company that supplies humanely certified eggs to Whole Foods. A year-long Direct Action Everywhere investigation shows chickens crammed into 1.5 square feet of space, drowning in feces and enduring physical trauma. Animal rights groups say the, quote, certified humane label provides no protection to animals. So what's really the truth here? And then there are the environmental questions and concerns. The meat and dairy industry is responsible for 14.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions. That's according to a new study by the Chatham House, an independent policy institute based in London. They say that's more than is produced by all cars, trains, planes, and ships in the world. So what are we to believe? There's so much information out there about environmental concerns, health concerns, and moral concerns. This has caused a lot of people to stop eating meat, to cut back on meat, or to buy meat that is labeled humanely raised, free-range, and antibiotic-free. But what is the truth? Is there such a thing as sustainable and humane meat? On today's show, we'll have a debate about whether eating meat is good or bad for our bodies, the planet, and the animals. Today, we're joined by Nicolette Hahn-Nyman. Nicolette spent many years as an environmental lawyer. She's author of the new book, Defending Beef. She argues that livestock play an essential role in maintaining grassland ecosystems, and milk and meat raised on grass are healthful and nutritious. Nicolette has been a vegetarian for almost 30 years, and she joins me here in studio. Hi, Nicolette. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Harold Brown. Harold spent over half of his life in agriculture, growing up on a beef farm in Michigan and later working in the dairy industry. Harold has been involved in the behind-the-scenes operation of food production that uses animals. Today, he's an activist advocating for social and environmental justice and animal rights. And Harold has been vegan for 25 years. He joins us from Ithaca, New York. Hi, Harold. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So you both have very interesting stories and backgrounds, and all of that has shaped your views today. So why don't we talk a little bit about how you got to where you are today? Nicolette, tell us a little bit about your background. You've been vegetarian for almost 30 years, and you're out with a book called Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production.
Yes, and I wrote an earlier book called Righteous Pork Chop, which was about kind of a broader view of the way animals are raised for food in this country today and describing how those systems came about and the problems with them. So I'm from Michigan. Interestingly, both of your guests today are from Michigan also, and I'm from southwestern Michigan. I grew up spending a lot of times outdoors and spent a lot of time in nature and majored in college in biology at Kalamazoo College and studied law and then went on to practice law and eventually became an environmental lawyer, working first for the National Wildlife Federation and then for Bobby Kennedy Jr. in New York. I was the senior attorney for the organization, the Waterkeeper Alliance. And that's really where my work began that related to the livestock industry, because Bobby Kennedy was seeing problems all around the United States, environmental problems, especially water quality issues that were attributable to livestock systems. And he felt that neither the government nor really any of the nonprofit organizations were effectively addressing it. So he charged me with launching a national campaign to try to address that. And so that was my full-time job for 2 years. During that time, I had the sort of pleasure and the sort of horror of visiting ranches and farms where livestock were being raised. On the industrialized operations, it was very troubling, both in terms of the lives that the animals led and also the very evident environmental problems that these systems caused and the problems they caused for the community, so the people who live there. In contrast to that, though, I was visiting a lot of farms and ranches that were raising animals very well and were predominantly grass-based farms, and I saw animals living very good lives. I saw farms that were ecologically beneficial, and I saw communities that were enhanced by the presence of these farms. So it was a dramatic contrast. When I married my husband, Bill Nyman, who's the founder of the Nyman Ranch Network of farms and ranches around the United States, he lives here in California in Marin County. I moved here from New York and initially did not intend to get involved in the ranch, but I found that day after day living on the ranch and seeing how things were being done there, I began to feel very interested and proud of what we were doing there, actually, because I saw really good land stewardship, I saw very healthy wildlife populations, and I saw animals living extremely good lives. So I began to actually work on the ranch itself, and that has been a large part of how I spend my time every day for the last almost 12 years. So I have all these different parts of my background.
And your ranch is in Bolinas.
Yes.
And that is Nicolette Hahn Nyman. She's author of the new book, Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. And Harold, you also have a really interesting background. You grew up on a beef farm in Michigan, and you also worked in the dairy industry. At what point did you decide to leave this industry, and how did you become an animal rights activist?
Well, I left the farm, basically, it was a series of events over time, but I had some health issues, and heart disease is rampant in our family. It's basically killed off all my family, and I'm one of the few surviving people. But it was when I was working in the dairy industry that I had an accident, had blood work done, and they told me I better make some changes. Otherwise, I'd probably have a bypass by the time I was 35. So I made some changes, but it kind of flew in the face of the way I'd been living and also what my family was doing. So I left the farm and I moved to Cleveland, Ohio. And that's where I made a connection, found out what a vegetarian was, and then later I found out what a vegan was. Because believe it or not, I never heard of those two words when I left Michigan. And I reversed my heart disease. I had hooked up with a guy in Cleveland named Dr. Esselstein and heard him at a talk, and I go, wow, this is what I need. And it worked. And I get my blood work done every year, and everything is cool. But more than that, beyond that, that was kind of the impetus of my journey. Beyond that was a few years later, I had an interaction with a steer that at a sanctuary that changed my life. And I realized that all these coping mechanisms and defense mechanisms that I had developed since I was a child, because I grew up on a farm and I was totally indoctrinated into herding culture, I was unable to see what these relationships were, not only with farm animals, but also with nature and also with wildlife. So that was the beginning of that. That's when I had this moral and ethical shift, because I was on a plant-based diet for a number of years before I finally made this, what I call the awakening of my animal consciousness. And that was, in some ways, one of the hardest things I did, but it was also one of the easiest things I did, because once I got emotionally honest with myself, that was tough. Because our culture does not teach men in particular to be emotionally honest with themselves. But once I did that, then everything just fell in place and it made sense. And I realized that, you know, all sentient beings are here for their own reasons, not mine, and that our 10,000 years of herding culture have basically created a situation that we literally are unable to see, unable to understand what is around us in these drivers that make us constantly look for validations of how we eat and how we live our lives and how we view non-humans. So now I work as an activist to pretty much full-time on many different levels, trying to help people with understanding their journeys. And also I work a little bit with farmers who are making the transition from animal agriculture into plant agriculture.
Harold Brown is a former beef farmer turned animal rights activist and founder of FarmKind.org. Nicolette Hahn Nyman is a former environmental lawyer. She spent many years doing that, and now she lives on a ranch in Bolinas, and she's author of the book Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. And I'd like to give out the phone number because this issue around sustainable, humane meat is getting so much attention these days. As I mentioned, you've got Carl's Jr. and Whole Foods and everything in between marketing and selling what they're calling humane meat. So what are your thoughts on this? What questions do you have about this industry? If you work in the industry, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Do you think there's such a thing as humane and sustainable meat? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Also, there's so many labels out there. You've got antibiotics, humane, cage-free, so many labels. What are your questions? What questions do you have about that? Nicolette, what are your thoughts on the moral argument? Again, you're a vegetarian. Why did you become vegetarian?
Well, I became a vegetarian when I was a freshman in college, and I was majoring in biology. I had already been active in environmental causes since almost literally childhood. And I was encountering a lot of information that said, basically, if you care about the environment, you shouldn't be eating meat. And at the time, it made sense to me, and I felt if I were really concerned about environmental issues, I should give up meat. My views on that obviously have evolved a great deal, because now, having witnessed systems all over the world and done a lot of research and reading for the last 15 years on this topic, not only do I view the possibility for raising livestock in a way that's not environmentally damaging, but I think that the most optimal systems ecologically do involve animals. So I've shifted my view a lot on that. That doesn't mean that there isn't ecological damage done from meat and dairy production. There most certainly is. There's also a huge amount of environmental damage done from crop production of all types. Agriculture has an enormous environmental footprint, so all types of agriculture have tremendous potential to do environmental damage. We need to address that urgently as a society. But to me, suggesting that getting rid of animals is the solution is not only overly simplistic, it's just wrong.
Well, before we get on that topic, what are your thoughts about the moral question? Because I'm noticing that when we talk about humane, sustainable meat, the moral issues tend to not really be part of that conversation.
Well, my book does have a whole section in the back discussing the ethics of it. I don't focus on that a lot because I feel that's really an individual question that people need to grapple with. And I've never tried to persuade someone who doesn't feel that they want to do that for ethical reasons that they should. What my book says is essentially if you feel that it's ethically acceptable to eat animals, then there are no health or environmental reasons not to do so, as long as you source your meat well. My own feeling is that humans are animals. Obviously, we are. That's not up for debate. But that we're very much part of an enormous system of plants and animals that are essentially continually cycled through the environment. We are alive for a period of time. Each of us will die and return to the earth. We become part, and that's what ashes to ashes and dust to dust is all about. That's what that age-old phrase comes from. And to me, we are part of that cycle. And suggesting that humans, that it's wrong morally to eat animals, to me doesn't make any sense, because it's totally counter to the way all of nature functions.
What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, mine?
Yes.
Oh, well, I find that kind of interesting, because dust to dust, nearly every person in the United States, if they're not cremated, they're buried in a hermetically sealed coffin in a hermetically sealed vault. So I don't know that that's a very good argument. But I would also say that I want to share something with you to kind of set the groundwork for part of this discussion. From Webster's New World Dictionary, the definition, and I'm reading this, the definition of humane is kind, tender, merciful. That's it. So, if you've been in 4-H, if you've been in FFA, you can raise cattle kindly and tenderly, but not a one of them is shown mercy. So it's bogus, in my book, to call any animal product you made, because first and foremost, it isn't. You can't make it humane in any ethical or moral way. And the other part of it is that, you know, what does that speak to us? What does that speak of our character as human beings? You know, as far as the environmental damage, all I can tell your listeners is to do your own damn homework. There's all these studies, like the ones you mentioned, read them. But everything that you read, follow the money. Who funded the studies? And you're going to find, you're going to be surprised when you dig what you're going to find. And the thing is, the science is basically in about the damage of agriculture. You know, as Nicoletta said, you know, that there is no way that you can do animal agriculture without having an impact. But it's a very damaging impact. And let me just expound on that for a moment.
And Harold, can I just step in really quick? I want to talk about the environmental effects. But first, I just want to talk about where this movement really came from, because it used to be that people looked for the USDA certified label on their meat. That was the big label that people looked for. And now it's humane and antibiotic free, cage free. How did this happen? Can you talk about that, Nicoletta? Well, where did this come from?
I do think there's been a great deal more interest coming from consumers. And so I think those labels arose out of the fact that the government wasn't really doing a very good job. And either they were simply disallowing language. They do actually disallow a lot of language, believe it or not. Or they were allowing language to be used that was not appropriate. So you mentioned the certified humane label. That's an example. In my view, that's not a very good example of a certification program. I've actually written and spoken specifically against that label because, in my view, they don't have standards that really represent, that offer an animal a good life. It's really a way of ensuring that animals that are raised in industrial facilities are not treated cruelly. That's good. I think that's good, but it's not enough. I think our standards should be much higher. So I think that it really comes from the fact that more and more consumers are trying to, there's more transparency desired in the food system. The food system now is very not transparent. It's kind of the opposite of transparent. Food is traveling an average of, you know, 1,500 miles before it gets to the consumer. There's a lot of processing. There's almost no knowledge when you go into a grocery store about where anything came from.
Right.
Even if it's just a piece of meat or a green pepper, you don't know where it came from a lot of times. But certainly if it's a processed food with dozens of ingredients, it's almost impossible to know the origins. So I think people are desiring to get back closer to the source, and I think that's very good. I mean, that's the good news.
Well, and so what would you say to citizens who are concerned about this? Because we've done shows about labels and what is the enforcement mechanism. And then there are so many undercover investigations. The Washington Post just had a piece about Purdue labeling. Purdue labels its chicken as, quote, humanely raised. But Craig Watts, a North Carolina chicken farmer who raises more than 700,000 chickens every year for Purdue Farms, was fed up with what he was seeing. So he allowed the group Compassion for World Farming to spend months at his farm with cameras documenting horrific conditions. And Craig Watts said, quote, this stuff is not advertised. The consumer is being hoodwinked.
Yeah.
Now, this is on eggs that are being labeled humane.
Yeah, I agree. That label should not have been allowed to be used on that. I think, obviously, the consumer has to have a certain amount of skepticism from a label that comes from the producer itself. I mean, I think that's a really important... That's where all these third-party certifications have come from, because people do have that skepticism. And I agree, anything that's raised in a sort of a industrial facility is, it almost can't be humane. I think that's it kind of inherently problematic. That's the whole argument I make in my book, Righteous Pork Chop. So I think that that's, I'm glad those things are being exposed. Mm-hmm. I think any farmer who's really committed to animals having a high quality of life, and I know many of them all over the United States, does not consider that form of animal raising humane.
Well, so how often or how common is it to see a humane label on whatever, a chicken, an egg, a piece of beef, and that animal was raised at a farm with 700,000 chickens versus a farm of 700 chickens? Does that even exist anymore?
Yes. I mean, if you this part of what I have been encouraging people for a long time is you really try to need to try to get closer to the source and try to get food from a place that you know and that you trust. And one of the best ways to do that is try to get food from your region or your, if possible, your locality, and if not possible, your region, and be able to speak directly to the person who's raising the food. I think that's the best way to know how your food is produced. And I agree for people, you know, for whom this is a really important issue, which is a growing number of people, they need to do some homework. They need to try to ask some questions about their food. And I personally don't think relying on labels is the best way to do that, because there's a lot of slippery slopes in the whole labeling issue.
Harold, what would you say to people who are really confused about this? I mean, like I said, there are a lot of undercover investigations that expose cruelty on these so-called humane farms, like the one I just mentioned.
Well, if anybody takes time to look at those videos, they'll see that what's exposed last week is no different than what was shown 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. The system doesn't change, and it can't. Because of economies of scale, it just can't. So it's always going to be what it is, and nobody should be surprised. It shouldn't be earth-shaking that there's a new cruelty investigation. It's the same old, same old. But as far as these labels go, you have to understand that the industry itself, the animal-using industry, spends millions, if not billions of dollars creating through focus groups and the best minds on Madison Avenue to create labeling that will entice customers to or consumers to buy products. And quite honestly, none of those labels have any kind of legal meaning. I mean, they don't have teeth. If you're raising pigs, let's say, and you've got like 25 pigs in your local supplier and you get certified by one of the nonprofit third-party certifiers, and then but you only get certified once a year, so there's no like snapshots over time what you're actually doing on the farm. The worst that can happen to you is you lose that label. That doesn't mean you can't go find another one. And when you do look at these, if you go look at all these different certifiers' websites, the standards, some of them are much higher and some are much lower. And so you can basically set the bar wherever you want to set it as a farmer. But the interesting thing for me is kind of a sociological aspect of this, in that, you know, when I was growing up on our farm, it was, you know, not a very big farm, and by today's standards, we would have been an organic grass-fed operation. But that said, we have gone to a situation now in the United States where the majority of people don't farm or have any connection to agriculture. Mm. According to the USDA agricultural census in 1950, about 48% of the population of the United States produced food. And as of the 2009 census, when the numbers were crunched in 2009, it's 0.8% of the population. It's less than 1%. But of that 0.8%, 16% of the 0.8% is producing 66.6% of all the food in the United States. This is the corporate consolidation of the food production in the United States, and that is by design. Now, when everybody wants to look at, well, what about small farms? What about grass-fed and so on and so forth? Again, it's a marketing campaign. It's brilliant in its conception, but the industry knew some time ago that they had a problem. They now had a generation and a half of Americans who didn't have any sort of knowledge or experience or tie to farm animals.
And Harold, hold that thought. Right after the break, we'll talk more about small farms. Today we are talking about whether it's possible to have sustainable, humane meat. It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
It is Your Call on Local Public Radio. Many ways to join in today's conversation. You can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can give us a call. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say. Following that, at noon today, Bina, today's Sotheby's Impressionist and Modern Arts Specialist Philip Hook reveals the inner workings of the fine art world, and will explain how art is assigned value. That's Bina coming up at noon today following World Have Your Say from the BBC, which begins at 11 o'clock.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll discuss coverage of President Obama's State of the Union speech. He focused on a number of economic issues, including tax reform, jobs and education. How does the media's obsession with political partisanship shape coverage of these issues? What are the facts about taxes and the economy? We will also be talking about what's happening in Yemen. We'll be joined by McClatchy's Mark Seibel and investigative reporter David K. Johnston. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're having a debate. Is there such a thing as sustainable and humane meat? It's being sold everywhere from Carl's Jr. to Whole Foods. So what questions do you have about this exploding industry? If this is something you buy, what attracts you to it? What do you think about all the labels you see at the store? And if you work in this industry, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Nicolette Hahn Nyman. She spent many years as an environmental attorney. She's author of the new book, Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. We're also joined by Harold Brown, former beef farmer turned animal rights activist. And Harold, since you were talking about small farms before the break, let's go to a caller who has a question about small farms. Let's hear from Patrick in Seaside. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
So my question is this. What kind of incentives are there for these local small organic farms compared to what you just described as the corporate farm, the 16% producing 66% food stuff?
Are you talking about small produce and animal farms?
I'm talking about either produce or animal farming.
Okay.
I'm under the understanding right now that there are a lot of farming subsidies to go out, and that having a corporate structure is more advantageous to taking advantage of those incentives. And I'm wondering what kind of things in legislation keep that out of balance.
All right. Thank you for the question, Patrick. Nicolette, do you want to take that one first?
Well, there's no question that the U.S. agricultural policy is part of the driver that has led to this very industrialized food system. Starting around the middle of the 20th century, there became the government became obsessed with the notion of increasing production, and especially of grains and of animal-based food, and the grains began to become more and more the basis of the diet of the animals because it became very cheap due to government subsidies. So I think what the caller is getting at, and I would agree, is that government policy has had a huge impact on shaping the current system and the very industrialized model, not just of animal agriculture, but of all agriculture. And I think we really do need to address that in this country and create incentives for more diversified agriculture, more locally based agriculture, more grass-based, less chemical intensive agriculture. And I really don't think we have a choice in this, because right now our whole food system is very heavily based on fossil fuels. And we know that that's a finite resource that is coming to an end.
On this issue, we were talking about this before the show, the New York Times had a long investigation a few days ago about the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center. It's a complex of labs and pastures that sprawl over 55 square miles in Nebraska. It's a taxpayer-financed institution. A lot of people don't even know this exists. And they find that farm animals are being re-engineered to just become bigger, to produce more offspring, yield more meat, and cost less to raise. And a lot of the people who work there say that they are shocked at what's happening at this place.
Yeah, I thought that was a very damning investigation. Both my husband and I read it, and we immediately made contact with Wayne Pacelli, the president of the Humane Society, and indicated that we wanted to support a letter to the organization and to the Secretary of Agriculture, Vilsack, and say we don't find this acceptable at all. And I think that that's the reaction, based on my Facebook conversations and other conversations I've been having with people about that article, that's the reaction of a lot of responsible farmers and ranchers that are raising livestock. People who really care about their animals don't want this being done through you know, USDA or anything else.
An example, pigs are having 14 piglets instead of the usual 8. Cows, which normally bear one calf at a time, have been retooled to have twins and triplets. In many cases, the cows are killing their own babies because they're just rolling over
That's
them.
The pigs.
That's right, the pigs.
They
but,
don't
yes,
do that.
Thank you.
But it was interesting. One of the things I did think was important about that article was when they talked about the whole, there was a whole discussion about creating twins in cattle. And of course, we raise cattle ourselves. So I was very especially interested in that part of the article. But it was very interesting. There was a whole long section discussing how the ranching community was really troubled by that and did not support it and specifically communicated that repeatedly to USDA. We don't want cattle that twin. We know this is a problem for both the animal and the rancher, so don't go down that pathway. But USDA was determined to do this. So that, to me, was a good example of how they're not necessarily even representing what farmers and ranchers want or need.
This piece is U.S. Research Lab Lets Livestock Suffer in Quest for Profit, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Again, I'm speaking with Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, author of Defending Beef. She lives on a ranch in Bolinas, and she's been vegetarian for almost 30 years. Harold Brown grew up on a beef farm in Michigan and later worked in the dairy industry. Today, he's an animal rights activist. He's been vegan for 25 years. And we're talking today about this growing explosion of the humane, sustainable meat movement. And if you have any questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. What choices do you make when you go to the store? What do you think about these labels and the explosion of what we're seeing? I was driving on the freeway yesterday, and Carl's Jr. has a big billboard on the highway with a hamburger that says, "It's natural." So you've got all kinds of players now in this movement. So what are your thoughts on this? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. It's been amazing to watch media coverage of these issues because we're facing a drought in California. A lot of animal rights groups are pointing to the fact that 80% of water is used by agriculture. And a new study came out from the Chatham House, an independent institute based in London, found that the meat and dairy industry is responsible for 14.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions. The UN is coming out with data. I mean, the NRDC has a lot of data about this. A lot of environmental groups are now talking about this. Nicolette, one of your arguments is that eating beef actually helps the environment. Can you explain this in terms that we can all understand?
Well, it basically goes back to soil and grass, because our whole, not just our food system, but our whole ecology of the globe is really dependent on ecosystems functioning properly. And the Earth was actually once covered for much of its history. We tend to think of environmental issues in terms of 100 years or 1,000 years, maybe even, but we don't think in terms of millions of years. You know, the Earth was once covered for tens of millions of years, actually, by far more animals than there are today. So the argument, the whole thesis of my book, is that in order to have properly functioning ecosystems, everything from the soils to the vegetation and to all life, insect life, smaller animals, elephants, everything depends on having properly functioning ecosystems. And that's absolutely the best way to mitigate climate change as well. In order to have those properly functioning ecosystems, we actually need these grazing animals to maintain the grasslands. That's the thesis of the book. And also that when you're properly grazing, I mean, again, going back to what I said earlier, if you don't do it well, it can be very damaging. That's absolutely true of all forms of agriculture, and it's definitely true with raising cattle as well. But when you do cattle grazing correctly, there was actually just an article in the Bay Area media a couple of days ago about the Tomcat Ranch down in Pescadero doing some research together with several university-based scientists showing that they had dramatically increased the presence of perennial grasses through well-timed grazing. And that's the thesis. I'm not arguing for all animal agriculture being good, but I'm saying when you do it correctly, especially cattle, because they live on grass, they can live entirely on grass, they actually enhance the soil, they enhance the diversity of both the plant life, the soil life, and all of the animal life. And that's what we need to be focusing on, is getting towards an agriculture that is enhancing the ecosystems, and cattle are an essential part of doing that.
So according to Farm Sanctuary, more than 30 million cattle are slaughtered for the beef industry every year in the United States. How many of those cattle are raised in this situation that you described? Do we know?
Well, all cattle are on grass for much of their lives. That's a really important fact that most people don't seem to realize. All mother cows are on grass for pretty much all of their lives, the bulls, the calves. And then it is after they're a year old, typically, that they go into a feedlot. The dairy industry is a little bit different. There isn't nearly as much cattle on grass in the dairy industry. But the point is that there's an environmental benefit for all of those cattle that are on grass, and especially if they're well managed. That's where you have an opportunity for carbon sequestration, for lots of habitat. I mean, Berkeley did a study, a biologist at Berkeley did a study a couple of years ago talking about the importance of rangelands in California for creating habitat for bees and other pollinators, because actually one of the largest sources of habitat for the wild pollinators in California today are the rangelands where cattle are.
Harold, as a former beef rancher, you grew up on a beef farm in Michigan. What are your thoughts on Nicolette's argument?
Well, I think we need to take a step back and look at a larger issue. The domestication of animals has created a situation where we don't even know what a natural ecosystem is. And if you can't be honest enough to recognize that, then you're not going to be able to put, you know, be able to do much critical thinking beyond that. But what we are dealing with now are unnatural ecosystems. And, yeah, sure, but just when it comes to cattle, and Nicolette knows this as well as anybody, that if you take a calf-cow operation and you take a steer and then compare one that's going to be grass-fed until slaughter weight, because it's all about getting an animal to slaughter weight, and one that goes from there to a feedlot, the one that's on grass-fed is going to live a little bit longer, actually quite a bit longer, than the one that goes on a feedlot. Now, as far as greenhouse gases, the one that's going to be on grass is going to be producing more greenhouse gases because it's going to be ruminating until the end of its life. The one that goes on the feedlot, it actually goes down. The generation of greenhouse gases from rumination goes way down because basically rumination gets shut down because they go on high-energy grain diets. So there's been quite a bit of research shown in by organizations like the World Bank and other independent researchers have shown that, you know, it's just not a valid argument to say that grass-fed systems are better for greenhouse gases. They're not. And it, again, comes back to economies of scale. We cannot raise enough animals to feed the demand either in the United States, North America, or the globe. We are in a major extinction event right now. And the other part of that is that part of the unnatural of this is predation has gone away, where humans now are the mega predator, not any other animal. So just the idea of domestication raises the idea that some lives matter less than others, and really that's the root of what's wrong in the world, with everything that's wrong in the world. And if we can't consider that moral question, then we've got a problem on this planet, because the human population is ever-growing, and we're not dying off quite fast enough, and we need more food. And as other economies become more affluent, they're eating more animal products.
Well, Nicolette, what about that question? As we see the demand for meat increase in places like China and India, is it possible to raise animals in the way you describe to feed millions, tens of millions of people, billions of
people? Yes. I mean, obviously there's a limit. There's a certain point at which but we're nowhere near that limit today. The Savory Institute, which is based in Colorado and does work all around the world to try to improve grazing practices, and they've done amazing work restoring landscapes through grazing. They've actually specifically analyzed the situation in the United States and found that there's about a 30% surplus of land available to produce the current amount of beef that is produced today using entirely grass-based methods, if you used good grazing techniques. So it's certainly not clear that you need to reduce or eliminate animals in order to have totally grass-based agriculture. There's also been, there was a think tank in Austria a few years ago that quantified the entire global food system in terms of getting rid of all factory farms and returning all animals to grass. And they as well, actually, they also looked at organic production because that's generally takes more land. And they found that with very minor reductions in consumption in the Western world, you could have ample space, to ample resources to raise all animals on grass and organically. So there's been there have been quite a few people who have quantified this. It's certainly feasible. The other thing is on the greenhouse gas emissions issue, there are very credible scientists all over the world, including at Berkeley, UC Berkeley, that have been looking at the extent to which cattle benefit carbon sequestration. And a study by the Union of Concerned Scientists looking specifically at the beef industry a few years ago suggested that as much as all of the greenhouse gases that are created by cattle could be offset through carbon sequestration. So it's by no means clear that there's a huge negative impact from cattle in the food system. And I argue in my book that when you consider all of the benefits of having animals grazing, because you always have to remember, if you're not raising the animals on grass, then you're raising some food somewhere to replace them. And if you have to plow the land, which is what you have to do for crop cultivation, that's the single most damaging thing you can do to land, whether you're talking about soils or water or anything else. That's the basis of the argument of the book, is grazing animals provide an opportunity to produce food that does not require the plowing of land.
Harold, what about that?
Oh, God, where do I start? Well, the International Agricultural Trade Policy Group has for years said that we are at a land use deficit in North America. And they do this study every 2 years. And that's why so many kilocalories we need to raise livestock in the United States and in Canada has come to a point, since we are at a land use deficit, that we're making up those kilocalories by taking marine life, grinding it up into fish meal, and feeding it. About a third of all sea creatures that are taken out of the ocean are used for food or fertilizer for crops and or animals. So, you know, we can sit here all day and throw facts and figures, you know, back and forth. But the thing is that really come to me, what it comes down to is what I've directly observed. And, you know, when you just consider that 2,500 cows on any sort of operation, any sort, land otherwise, are producing as much waste as 1,444,000 people. That's a large city. And while a city is required to have waste management, you know, practices for cleaning up that stuff, you don't on a farm. We call it nutrients. Right, Nicole? It's called nutrients. And it goes back into the soil. But there's only a certain carrying capacity to the soil, and you do have runoff, and that is why we have about 500 dead zones in the oceans around the world because of animal agriculture.
I actually talk about all of these issues extensively in my first book, Righteous Pork Chop, and I worked as an environmental lawyer for several years, specifically focused on the livestock industry, so I'm very familiar with these issues. I was directly involved in lawsuits over these issues, and I have to say it's really important to note that the dead zones, especially the largest one in the Gulf of Mexico, which is now believed to be the size of the state of New Jersey, is due to crop production in the upper Midwest. It's not directly due to animal agriculture, although there's a portion of those crops that are going to feed livestock, that's true. But it's crop production. It's the plowing of the land. It's the fertilization and the other agricultural chemicals that are being used to grow those crops, those vegetable crops. So it's very important to be accurate here. And also, the whole point I'm making is that when you're raising animals well, when you're doing it in an ecologically appropriate way, that it offers a more ecological food system than one that doesn't include animals. I'm not saying the current system is ecologically sound. I've been a very vocal critic of it for 14 years. I'm saying we need to move towards a more ecologically sound system, and that system should have animals in it.
Why?
because of the fact that it represents an opportunity for the most ecologically sound food system. And we haven't even talked about it, but we were going to. I hoped we were going to talk about the nutritional advantages of animal-based foods. They are incredibly nutrient-dense.
Actually, we've got some calls on that. But Harold, do you want to respond, and then we'll get to a call?
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, people want to talk about industrialized agriculture, factory farming as a boogeyman. But the point is that none of it is right. I mean, this is not taking into account the interests of, well, to back up a little bit, according to the USDA, about 78% of all crops grown in the United States go down the throat of a farm animal. Now, that doesn't, scale really doesn't matter. That is a hard fact. That's why we have a dead zone. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. We don't have time for these baby steps toward, you know, this locavore idea, because we're in a crisis. We are running out of fresh water. And that is probably our biggest crisis that we face globally and here in the United States, especially here in California. You ought to be able to appreciate this. We don't have time to talk about this. We have to protect riparian laws, you know, riparian right-of-ways. We have to protect our groundwater. We have to stop doing the things that use the most water, which is raising livestock and pumping out the Ogallala Aquifer, because the recharge rate of that aquifer is hundreds of years, not two rainy seasons.
The most ecologically sound form of livestock production is actually a way of saving water, because the soil and the earth, when it is in its healthiest state, which is how it is when you have well-managed animals on it, are actually a far better sponge for water, and ecosystems can be much better restored when you have the presence of animals as part of those systems. That's the reason, going back to your question of why, that's why. If you want to have long-term sustainability in terms of both the soils and the water, which are the basis for our food system, you have to have animals.
What about the water question? This is getting a lot of attention these days. There's a study out of Cornell that finds in order to produce 1 pound of beef, you need 1,600 gallons of water compared to 102 gallons for a pound of wheat.
Yeah, well, I mean, those are David Pimentel's figures. And I actually think he is a great thinker, and I agree with a great deal of what he says. But that's a worst-case scenario. And what I cite in my book is the research of UC Davis, where they looked at what a typical pound of beef in the United States takes. And it's a very detailed analysis. And they found that actually it's slightly more than what it takes to produce a pound of rice. It's not so much more water-intensive than other foods. Almonds, walnuts, avocados, there are many water-intensive foods that we produce in the United States and in California. And actually, when you consider the benefits that well-managed grazing provides in terms of ecosystem holding of the water that I was just talking about a minute ago, I think there's a net benefit in terms of water for the state of California and elsewhere when you have grazing animals.
Harold, what about the question of water? I mean, what are people supposed to do when they have these studies that are wildly, wildly different?
Well, I tell them to do their own research, and like anything else, dig into who paid for the research. If you're looking at a land-grant college for objective research, that went away in the 1980s. That just went away because now colleges have a profit motive to doing research. So it's, you know, you need to look and pay attention to who's paying for the research, because you can find research to substantiate just about any damn thing you want.
And Cornell is a land grant university as well.
Yeah, I live right next to it.
So
it's one of the top dairy colleges in the United States, and it is amazing what they'll do to protect their self interest in the dairy industry. But it's, you know, and we see it constantly in environmental level, just in our area, in my own backyard, and what they'll do. The lengths they'll go to protect the dairy industry here, regardless of what they do, whether it's treatment of animals, whether it's treatment or water quality issues in the Finger Lakes and stuff, they can spin statistics and information to protect themselves. And that's basically what it is. It's a defense mechanism, and that's, you know, that's just the way it works. But, again, you know, for me, this really comes back to this idea of, do we have the right of domestication? And, you know, I don't know. I know you want to talk about health aspects. And, again, I'll kick that off.
Why don't you? We've got a few calls. We only have a few minutes. People are calling in about the health impacts of eating meat, eggs, and cheese.
Okay, well, take dairy for instance. Take Cornell for instance. It, because of telling the truth of objective through objective science about the, you know, the problems of not only animal proteins but dairy in particular, it basically cost T. Colin Campbell, who was a professor there, his position at Cornell. And you know, you can say, oh, well, that's just one person. But if the information that's being put out by Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and by T. Colin Campbell and by many others about not only the problems but the dangers of consuming dairy products, cheese in particular, was not correct, then you have food disparagement laws that would kick in, and all of these organizations and individuals would be taken to federal court. But it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen because their own science knows. And when I worked in a dairy plant, I started learning about these things from the safety inspectors from Michigan State University, and it shook my world. But the thing is it's like Tony Robbins always says, we want good news about bad habits. So, yeah, you can always find research. You can always find some expert, some PhD, who will substantiate your point of view. But the thing is when you look at cancer rates in the United States, it's now on par with heart disease.
And Harold, we've got about a minute left, and I also want to get Nicolette to respond.
Yeah, well, when you look at the demographic data in the United States, our red meat consumption has actually gone dramatically down, about 25% down over the last few decades. Our overall consumption of animal fats has been way down for the last few decades. It's down about 21% over the last century. It is not sensible to connect those foods with the rising rates of chronic diseases. I mean, my book goes into the issues, the health and nutrition issues, in a lot of detail, and there have been a lot of other people writing about this as well. But it's simply untrue to suggest that there are rising rates of these diseases and rising rates of consumption of animal products and fat. It's actually the opposite. So that doesn't support that view at all. I think that the most recent research on fats and meats shows that it is only dangerous when it has been highly processed. So there's good research now showing that grilling is dangerous for your health, has been connected to cancer, and processing and nitrates and things like that are problematic. But fresh meat and fresh dairy products are not dangerous to your health.
We could probably do an entire hour just on that question.
Yes.
Nicolette Hahn-Nyman is author of the book Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production, and Harold Brown is a former beef farmer turned animal rights activist. Nicolette is vegetarian, Harold is vegan. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of President Obama's State of the Union speech. He focused on a number of economic issues. How does the media's obsession with political partisanship shape coverage of domestic and foreign policy issues? We'll be joined by McClatchy's Mark Seibel and investigative reporter David K. Johnston. What grabbed your attention in the media this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.